When I interviewed David Gilmour about it a few years ago, I mentioned it with him, and he said to me they had a big playback in Abbey Road once it was all done, dusted. And he said they just sat there and went, yeah, this is fantastic. This is a great record. We knew we'd done a great piece of work.
It is time to breathe. Talk about us and them and money. Welcome to Rock Conversations. I am the self-proclaimed patriarch of rock and roll, Rob Hahn, otherwise known as Rob Bob. And the voice you heard earlier is that of Mark Blake, an author of many great books about rock and roll, including one entitled Pigs Might Fly, The Inside Story of Pink Floyd. You can find all of Mark's books and purchase them at markrblake.com. Make sure you get the middle initial in there, markrblake.com. And in just a few seconds, we're going to talk namely about the 50th anniversary of the release of Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon. Well, we're not going to just talk about the anniversary. We're actually going to talk about the album itself. I mean, who among us doesn't have a memory or two of listening to Dark Side of the Moon? I certainly do. I'll share some of them, and Mark does as well. Before we get into it, let me remind you that you can listen to Rock Conversations wherever you get your podcasts, whether it's Apple, Spotify, or even on our website, rockconversations.com. Be sure to share the idea and the links with a friend or two. We'll take all the listeners we can get. So without further ado, let's get into our rock conversation with Mark Blake.
Oh, let's go back, let's go back, let's go back.
50 years in, and Dark Side of the Moon is still looked at as one of the greatest albums of all time. What's your first memory of listening to it? I want to start with kind of a personal observation, if I could.
Yeah, sure. I think I heard it when I was about 13 the first time. So that would have been in the late 70s. It was a little while after it had come out, probably about 45 years ago, I think, in hindsight. So, I just found it in someone's record collection. Somebody who was older than me had a bunch of LPs, and that was in there, and I picked it out straight away, obviously because of how it looked. It didn't look like any other record, and so I immediately was intrigued to hear it.
My experience was a little different. It was a little later, and I was familiar with the album in title and some of the songs, but I had never purchased it. And I bought a CD. I thought, oh, this is going to be great. It was the second CD I ever bought. I bought them simultaneously. Peter Gabriel's So, which I listened to first, and then came to Dark Side of the Moon. Mm. And it sounds cliche to say it blew me away, but to listen to it as a full album or full CD was so different than getting a song or two on the radio. What do you think keeps it front and center? Why are we talking about it today, almost 50 years after its release?
Well, I think it's a great rock album, but it works on two levels. If you want to get involved in the story of it, if you want to think that there's a deeper meaning behind it, there's stuff there to explore. But it also works on a basic level as just a great collection of songs. I mean, the phrase concept album kind of gets bandied around a lot in the 70s, but the concept of Dark Side of the Moon is whatever you want to make it, really, because it's about life. It's just about real life. It's about death and madness and money and all the things that kind of never go out of fashion in a way. And I think that's helped it an awful lot. There isn't a deep, convoluted story in there like you might have from some of their contemporaries in the 70s. It's quite user-friendly. And although there's some strange stuff going on there as well with the spoken word and sound effects and things like that, it doesn't really intrude on it. You can enjoy that stuff as well. It makes it interesting, makes it intriguing. So I think there's a lot to listen to, but it works on two levels.
What I found interesting from reading your book, we're talking with Mark Blake, Pigs Might Fly is the Inside Story of Pink Floyd. What a great title, Pigs Might Fly. And we'll talk more about the pigs in a little bit. but what kind of struck me, and I consider myself the self-proclaimed patriarch of rock and roll. And there's a reason I say self-proclaimed, because I don't know everything. I just pretend to know everything. What I did not know until reading your book is Pink Floyd, before recording the album, tested, if you will, or played some of these tunes live in advance of going into the studio. I found that pretty unique. You know, these days we think of, and for years, it's like the band records the album, then they go on tour to support it. This was a little different.
Yeah, they were playing it version of what became Dark Side of the Moon for almost a year before the album came out, and there were recordings from about a year before. So, I mean, that's quite challenging for an audience to sit through, you know, 40 minutes of material they didn't know. But I guess it probably says something about the times that they were living through. But I thought it was interesting. I mean, you can hear the songs develop if you listened. I mean, there was a bootleg from a show they did in London that sold very, very well, sort of under the counter at record shops in Oxford Street. You had to sort of ask for it, I think. And the band were actually worried that that might impact on sales when the album itself came out, because you can hear the songs developing. They don't quite sound like it does on the finished album. But yeah, that is unusual. I mean, they road tested it, didn't they, for that length of time?
Yeah, not only is that rare, but you're spot on with what you say. To some extent, even once an album comes out, I joked with my sons years ago, I went to see Elton John, and he was touring to support Songs from the West Coast. He had gotten back together with Bernie Taupin, and I thought the album was excellent. The minute he said, "This is one from the new album," half the audience got up and went to the bathroom. It was like code for bathroom break.
Yeah, and there's all these bands today. I mean, The Who, The Stones, everyone that's still touring, any level, will face that problem. They make jokes about it. I remember interviewing Pete Townsend a few years ago, and he says, "I can see it happen. You play a new song and suddenly a whole row gets up." He said, "You see it happening," but their argument is, you know, this is what we need to do. But then you've got to go back 50 years. Everybody was younger. Their audience were younger. There were less distractions. No one's checking their phone. Venues in the UK, I've got to tell you, were just horrific. They were still pretty bad, even when I started going to shows in the early 80s. They weren't luxury. I mean,
like structurally, they were kind of barren.
They were just terrible. They were Dickensian. So, you know, it was like something out of the Victorian age. You know, you went to Earl's Court. It was a cavern. I mean, I know, you know, every time I see these film of Zeppelin at Madison Square Gardens in the 70s, it looks amazing and glamorous. You know, come down to the Empire Pool in Wembley. That was shocking in you know, even in the 80s or whatever.
How was the sound in those arenas? Did the sound at least
pretty
carry
bad.
Okay?
Earl's Court was terrible. Earl's Court were terrible. Things are a lot better now. You know, they are better in that sense. It's more corporate and all the rest of it, but there is luxury. You know, I mean, you know, the old Wembley Stadium stank of urine for years till they built a new one.
The one where they held Live Aid?
Yeah, yeah.
And it was just a regular scent of urine, huh?
It's a strong scent of urine. I remember going up there to see the Rolling Stones many times. Yeah, it wasn't a great place, not by the end. You know?
So apparently the fans were not skipping out on the songs to go to the bathroom. They just went right in their seats.
I don't know what was going on. I think they'd given up cleaning it by the 90s. Yeah.
We're talking with Mark Blake. We're focused today on the 50th anniversary of the release of Dark Side of the Moon from Pink Floyd. We know, when I say we, music consumers are very familiar with Alan Parsons from his Alan Parsons Project, but he had an integral role in the recording of Dark Side of the Moon.
Yes, he did. But he was employed as a sound engineer. He was working at Abbey Road at the time. And I believe it was his suggestion to use the clocks, the sound of the alarm clocks and all the ticking clocks that you have at the beginning of time. I think that was one of his ideas. I think he'd recorded some stuff before. He'd actually gone to a clock shop and recorded these sounds, and he suggested putting it on there. But yeah, he played a big part in the album. He was there in the bunker with them dealing with it.
When you look at Dark Side of the Moon and compare it to later Pink Floyd albums, I guess, namely The Wall, how involved was the band and specifically Roger Waters and David Gilmour when it came to the mixing and the editing?
Well, look, very involved, I think, on Dark Side of the Moon. And they actually got somebody in from the outside, Chris Thomas, who'd previously worked, I think, with Roxy Music. He'd done some work with the Beatles as well. He'd worked with George Martin. He came in as a sort of referee or an umpire, whatever you want to call it in sports terms. And he was there to mediate because David Gilmour wanted it to sound one way and Roger Waters wanted it to sound another. I don't know what the difference was. I'm not even sure they can completely remember now, but they got Chris Thomas in just to oversee things and keep it civil and work out how they wanted to sound. And everybody was happy with it, I believe, at the end of the day.
And you just answered the next question I had. I want to get a feel for from your research, not just with the immediate release, but over time, do you find that the band members still look back at Dark Side of the Moon in a very favorable
I think
fashion?
so. Yeah, definitely. I mean, I interviewed Roger David Gilmour about it a few years ago. I mentioned it with him, and he said to me they had a big playback in Abbey Road once it was all done, dusted. And he said they just sat there and went, "Yeah, this is fantastic. This is a great rec. We knew we'd done a great piece of work." I think he had a bet as well with his manager because his manager reckoned it was going to go top 10 or something in America, and Gilmour didn't think it would. And he lost a lot of money, but obviously he made a lot of money because it sold so many copies. So he wasn't convinced it was going to be a hit in America. I
And
do remember.
do I recall from your book, the Floyd, as they're often referred to? I like that. We always call him Pink Floyd, but I like the Floyd. That's pretty cool.
Okay.
They did not like singles, but I think
No.
it was Money that went out as a single and really
In
galvanized the
America.
album. Yeah.
Yeah, in the States, yes. I don't think it did over here, but they did. I think they had to sort of allow it. DJs were playing it, and they did put it out as a single. It was a big. That was a big single in the States as well. It was a game changer for Pink Floyd. I'm not sure so much here in the UK, but I know that single was it was a real game changer for them.
That song and the whole album to me are somewhat ironic. I love irony. You had Roger Waters claiming to be a socialist, but he was truly becoming a rich capitalist, I think, by the time that album hit.
Yeah, I mean, it all made a lot of money. Not straight away, but afterwards, suddenly everyone's got a bigger house, they're driving a nicer car, and the pressure was obviously on Roger Waters to keep writing because I think EMI were like, well, hey, let's have Dark Side of the Moon 2 now. They wanted something that was going to do the same. I mean, it's a classic situation because up until then they'd been a big cult band. They could earn a living and they were doing well, but since the late 60s, they were still a cult band. With that album, they become kind of public property. The world knows about. People bought the album that had never bought a Pink Floyd record before and maybe never bought one again after.
And it came at a time, and one of the things we do with Rock Conversations is look at the heyday or the halcyon days of FM radio, which I consider the 70s for sure, and to some extent, the early to mid 80s. Pink Floyd was a band, I think, almost custom made for FM radio in the United States in the 70s.
Yeah, I mean, we never had FM radio here in the UK. So, again, we're back to the Dickensian world of urine smelling venues. And we had like four radio stations in the whole country. The BBC had four radio stations, and you had smaller local radios, so radio stations. So if I ever wanted to hear Pink Floyd on the radio, they were never played on the radio in the daytime. There may be two radio shows that I grew up with. In the late 70s, very early 80s, it would play Pink Floyd, and they would have been broadcasting between 9 o'clock at night and midnight. So you just they Pink Floyd didn't they had no presence on television or radio here in the UK, apart from the odd late night show.
Was this the final album of their current record deal?
No, I don't think so. Not in the UK. No,
Okay.
no.
In the US, was it? I mean, I may
Could have
have
been in
things
the
mixed up. Were they
US,
with
yeah.
Capitol and then they went to
Yeah, I
Columbia or
think
something
went
like
to
that?
Columbia or something like that. I might have got it the other way around. Yeah, there was definitely some changes in the States. Yeah.
It's very interesting to me. I don't know if it's fortuitous luck or good fortune. Well, it's definitely that. But, a lot of these artists. Not a lot, but a number of them kind of, they reach a certain point where the record label thinks you got to make it big or you're not going to stay with us. I remember Tom Petty had it when he came out with Damn the Torpedoes, Bruce with Born to Run. And, this Dark Side of the Moon really took them to a different stratosphere, did it not?
It did, definitely. I'm not sure that they were on. I'm not sure they had a gun to their head the way that perhaps Tom Petty or Springsteen did. I think they had a lot of sway with the record company here. It's certainly here in the UK. They were very pig-headed and very self-sufficient and very sure of themselves. And they had a very strong manager, Steve O'Rourke, who kind of kept everybody away from them. So they were able to function and do the music they wanted to tour when they wanted to, and they kept the record company at bay. So I'm not sure that it was like, hey, you've got to sell a few million now or you're out. But yeah, it was definitely a big game changer for them.
Author Mark Blake is our guest today. He's the author of a number of books, including Pigs Might Fly, The Inside Story of Pink Floyd. Your most recent release this year, if I'm not mistaken, is called Us and Them, The Authorized Story of Hypnosis, which has many Pink Floyd angles to it. But tell us more about that book.
Well, Hypnosis were the company that designed all the sleeves for Pink Floyd, Led Zeppelin. They did stuff for Paul McCartney, many big acts in the 70s. And the two main guys in Hypnosis, Storm Thorgerson and Aubrey Powell, grew up in Cambridge in the UK with members of Pink Floyd. So Storm Thorgerson had been to school with Syd Barrett and Roger Waters. They both knew David Gilmour. So the book is about their adventures as a company, because they lived like rock stars and behaved like rock stars and fell out like rock stars. And it talks about how all the fun and games they had spending Pink Floyd's money and Led Zeppelin's money and McCartney's money, flying around the world photographing these elaborate album covers.
Well, let's talk about a few of those covers. It's odd to use a podcast to talk about covers, but I think our audience is familiar enough with these iconic covers or can look them up as they're listening to us. Let's start with Dark Side of the Moon. That took them overseas, if I'm not mistaken.
Absolutely. Yeah, that was a huge album for them. And what had happened before that is that they'd done four or five covers for, I believe, Floyd before then. And some of them have been quite unusual, a bit surreal, a bit abstract. The keyboard player in Pink Floyd, Rick Wright, said, look, can we just not have one of your surreal ideas? Can we have something graphic and clean and simple? And he actually asked for something that looked like a Black Magic box of chocolates. And Black Magic was a very popular brand of chocolates. It was the kind of thing you bought your elderly grandparents at Christmas, and it had a very simple black design with a line going across it. And when he said it, everybody laughed, and Storm Thorgerson was very upset and very annoyed because he brought a lot of elaborate ideas to show. But then they went away and they found a physics textbook, an old kid school textbook that had the prism and the rainbow going through it, like you see in Dark Side of the Moon. And I've got the original copy of the original here, and it's pretty much as you see on the cover of the album. So they got their artist, a guy called George Hardy, who did these beautiful hand-drawn images. Because remember, this is the days before Photoshop and digital technology, so everything's done by hand. And he drew a beautiful design. They brought it back to Abbey Road, where the band were finishing off Dark Side of the Moon. They had all these ideas hung up around. I think they had them out on a table or up on the wall. Everyone in Pink Floyd walked in, ignored everything else, all pointed at the prism and the rainbow, and said, that's it, that's the one. Yeah. And it's followed them around ever since. I think if you held it, stood on a street corner and held up that cover and asked people what it was, they'd know it was Dark Side of the Moon.
Oh, absolutely.
Even if they didn't know the record, even if they couldn't name a song on the record.
Did they go to Egypt to film, not film, but photograph the pyramid?
Yes, they did, because they wanted to spend money anyway, because of course it's quite cheap just to draw a prism of the rainbow. And they wanted a trip to Egypt, because normally they were used to going to the Sahara and doing all this elaborate stuff. So they persuaded them to pay for a sort of tinted photograph of the Great Pyramid in Egypt. Yeah, they
You
were out.
recount, yeah, you
Yeah.
recount in your book an interesting story about the photo shoot. One of the members of Hypnosis was unable to attend. I think he was tending to some physical issues in the bathroom,
That's right. That was,
and the other one was out there in the middle of the night or something like that.
that's right. Everybody got struck down with a sort of stomach bug, apart from Storm Thorgerson on this day. And he went out about 2 o'clock in the morning, got a taxi driver to drop him off to go down and shoot, photograph the pyramids at night. Obviously, very eerie, very atmospheric. He didn't realize he'd wandered into a sort of military shooting range. And he was suddenly approached by soldiers carrying guns, asking him what on earth he was doing. And he had to pay his way out of it, I think, just to, so they didn't arrest him or shoot him.
Another great cover that I think, and you'll correct me if I'm wrong, another great cover I think Hypnosis had a hand in, more than a hand in, was the Animals cover. Is that correct, with the pig on it?
That's right, with the pig flying over Battersea Power Station, the inflatable pig. It was actually Roger Waters' idea to do the pig. But yes, they photographed. They had this thing commissioned by a German company that had made airships during the First World War. Huge 30-foot inflatable pig was attached on a winch up between the towers of Battersea Power Station, which is a big landmark here in South London. Very imposing looking Victorian sort of building. The pig goes up there, and unfortunately, I think there was something rusty on the winch. The pig broke free, escaped, and of course, it shot up an incredible rate of knots into sort of, well, into the air traffic area. I mean, this is the point is Battersea is on the way in for landing at Heathrow Airport. And they had to phone the police. They had to make people aware of this. A police helicopter was scrambled and went up there to kind of chase the pig, but it was going too high. It got past, they stopped. I think they stopped planes landing at Heathrow for a little while. There was a big news announcement on the BBC here. It was quite a serious deal, and Aubrey Powell was sort of not arrested, but the police escorted him back to the office, and they had to wait for the pig to reappear, which it did in a farmer's field several hundred miles away. It deflated gradually as time went on and the temperature dropped. The helium came out of the balloon and it collapsed in a field. And they dragged it, got it back to London, and they did it all over again the next day.
I mean, you can't script something like this.
No,
If
you
someone sat
can't. I
down and said,
mean,
how can we promote our new
yeah.
album? I don't think this would come into someone's mind right away.
Yeah, it was on new. I mean, it was all over the newspapers. I remember seeing it as a kid reading about it. It was in the papers at the time. A lot of people thought it was a publicity stunt, but it was a genuine accident because it would have been very, very dangerous. It could have collided with a low-flying aircraft or caused all sorts of havoc. Yeah.
Well, I think you note in your book that the following day, when they came out to shoot again, shoot meaning the photos, they also had someone standing by ready to shoot it down if it got loose. And that made me think of the Chinese air balloons that came into US airspace. You know,
Yeah.
talk about the timing.
Yes, they had a police marksman. They should have had a marksman the day before, but I think they'd forgotten to book him, or they hadn't paid, or something had gone wrong. I think it was just human error, a bit of an oversight. But yes, they did. I was reminded of the pig when I heard about the Chinese balloons. Yeah.
Let's get back to hypnosis, or stay on the topic of hypnosis. Tell us a little more about the book and hypnosis in general, as it does not apply to Pink Floyd. They clearly have done work for other artists along the way.
Yeah, I think Paul McCartney and Led Zeppelin would be the two biggest artists that they did work for. Quite an unusual relationship because Led Zeppelin, more like Pink Floyd, if they had a great idea, Led Zeppelin would let them go away and do it. So if they wanted to shoot children crawling over the rocks, it looks like the surface of Mars for the cover of House of the Holy, Zeppelin were like, go ahead and do it. They did an album called Presence later that just had this mysterious black object on the cover, which was inserted into loads of different photographs of sort of everyday scenes.
Yeah, I didn't really
Zeppelin
get
were like,
that. I didn't get that or the album itself. I tried.
They love that. They absolutely loved it. They were like, yeah, this is great. This is amazing. Let's do what we want. With Paul McCartney, it was different because with McCartney, they'd turn up with ideas and he'd listen and then he'd reach into his pocket, take out a crumpled piece of paper, and he went, this is an idea I've got. And so, because he was a Beatle, they had to swallow it. So, all the Paul McCartney Wings album covers that Hypnosis did were all Paul or Linda McCartney's ideas. Hypnosis photographed them, but most of it was all McCartney's own ideas. So there was always, normally if another band had suggested that, they'd have told them, no, we want to do this. But because he was a Beatle, I think they had to roll over. So Storm couldn't stand it. Storm Thorgerson would have enough. He got up and walked out of the meetings. So it fell to Aubrey Powell to deal with Paul McCartney, and he had a very, very successful working relationship for over 10 years. But that's how every meeting went. Hey, these are great ideas, guys, but here's one of mine, and this is what we're doing. I guess you couldn't say no to a Beatle.
Right, the battle of the artiste, and one is way up here and the others are just kind of down
That's
here.
it. That's
What
it.
albums do you recall? What albums they worked on for McCartney and Wings?
Band on the Run, Venus and Mars.
That's a great cover, Venus and
Yeah,
Mars. Good album too.
with the balls on the pool balls, isn't it, on the table? Yeah, Band on the Run, Venus and Mars. I mean, all of them. Wings at the Speed of Sound, Back to the Egg, Wings Over America. Pretty much everything up until the early 1980s.
And those mostly came from, or exclusively from, Paul's pocket of
Paul
crumbled
or
up
Linda's
pieces of
brain.
papers.
Yeah, pieces of
Nice.
paper.
We're talking with Mark Blake. Let's circle back to Pink Floyd. And as we wrap up and talk about Dark Side of the Moon, as we celebrate 50 years since its release on March 1st, 1973, you bring up McCartney, Beatles. So let's segue back to Abbey Road Studios. What is it about Abbey Road Studios that's so special outside that of the fact that the Beatles recorded there? I mean, they've seen some great musicians come and go and produce some great work out of those studios.
Yeah, I think it was the quality of the equipment, really. I mean, musicians will, it's all about what they a musician can get out of the studio. I think the history is one thing, but I think it's the fact that they had state-of-the-art recording technology, state-of-the-art desks, state-of-the-art equipment. That was the main thing. Also, Pink Floyd's manager had negotiated a deal with EMI, because EMI owned the studio as well, that in exchange for a very small drop in royalties, Pink Floyd could get unlimited studio time there, which meant that whereas other groups, the clock would be ticking, you know, hey, guys, this has cost us another £100. They had the freedom to spend time in there. And I think that made a big difference.
Do you ever see another Floyd reunion?
Absolutely not. No.
Okay. I was going to ask if you thought it would be a good idea, but if you don't see it.
No, terrible. No.
It seems that over the years, and maybe this is stating the inherent obvious, that Roger and David just could not see eye to eye. And I'm not sure anyone can really see eye to eye with Roger.
Yeah, they don't see eye to eye at all. But I also think the best work has been done. They did their best work together, you know, 50 years ago, you know, maybe a little more recently than that. But I think it's a moment in time. It's done.
Yeah.
And I think it would be very risky to go back and try and capture that again. And I don't, but like you say, I don't think the relationship would even allow that.
What do you think in chronicling Pink Floyd, what are your thoughts personally as a consumer of music of the first couple albums that came out after Roger left the band? You had Learning to Fly and what, Division Bell?
Yeah, Momentary Lapse of Reason. And
Momentary Lapse of Reason, yeah, thank you.
Learning, that's right, Learning to Fly was a song on that, wasn't it? Yeah,
it was, yeah. I kind of like those two albums. I didn't think they were great, but I didn't think that they were just putting out crap.
No, I think I feel exactly the same way about them. They're not records I'd go back to very much now. I think the Momentary Lapse of Reason suffers because it's got a lot of the technology of the time, the 80s. There's a lot of that 80s gated drum sound, which a lot of artists did that at the time. Not just Pink Floyd, everybody did, because a lot of groups from the 60s and 70s didn't want to be left behind. So everybody got hung up on the technology. And I do think that perhaps it's those albums have dated a little bit. Weirdly, they've dated more than some of the stuff from the 70s in some ways. I don't think it's their best work, but no, I don't think they're terrible albums. And I think there's a couple of very good songs on them both. There's a song called High Hopes on Division Bell, which I think is a really good song. And that feels like it's very much connected to what they did before. That feels very much a part of that.
In our few minutes we have remaining, I want to go back and forth between you and me. We'll each pick a couple songs, one at a time, from Dark Side of the Moon, either your favorite or one that stands out for a specific reason and why. So you can start.
I would say Time, because I think it's got the best guitar solo on the album, which is sort of halfway through it, I think. Definitely Time. I also like Us and Them. But as
that's not fair. You took my answers.
But Us and Them really goes on a bit, doesn't it? It goes on
a bit. It does. I just
it
like the walks. Yeah. I like the feel and the emotion and the sensitivity of Us and Them. So that's definitely one of my favorites. And then Time, I've always loved the song, but I'll also always remember one time when I heard it. It was 1987. I was visiting my grandma at that time for Thanksgiving, a couple days before Thanksgiving, and I was listening to WXRT in Chicago, an FM station. And they were playing Time mid-morning. And when you get to that, you mentioned the great guitar solo. They faded out and said that Mayor Harold Washington had been taken to the hospital. And he died later that day, or he probably died right on the spot. But I'll never forget having the, you know, because you never, on an FM station, you almost never cut into a song, right? Unless there's some major news. And this was it. And so every time I hear that guitar solo, I think that I'm sitting at in the den at my grandma's house listening to WXRT. Nonetheless, I digress, but they're good memories.
It's ruined it for you. I have a similar story, but it's a bit long-winded to go into now, but I have a similar experience with The Wall, Pink Floyd, The Wall.
I
was recording it. This is how arcane things were in England in the late 1970s, I think I was recording some Pink Floyd music with a handheld mic with a microphone. It wasn't even an internal built-in music center.
Well, I've done that before it. Back in grade school.
I was recording it. And I think it was the wall. And all of a sudden, during a very quiet, sensitive moment, I could hear my dad calling upstairs for my brother. So when I went to see Pink Floyd at Earl's Court in 1980, since it's on the recording, so when I lent the tape out to some friends and listened to it, they said, "Why is your dad shouting on that?" I said, "Oh, sorry, he names outside calling for my brother." So when we went to see Pink Floyd at Earl's Court performing The Wall at this very, very quiet moment, my friend leaned over to me and just quietly whispered my brother's name in my ear to remind, because he couldn't listen to the piece of music without hearing my dad's voice bellowing up a flight of stairs in 1979.
So, I love it.
We've all got these horrible experiences. We've all had music ruined for us.
Yeah. It's been great talking with you. Mark Blake has been our guest, author of many books, including one on Pink Floyd called Pigs Might Fly, a new one about hypnosis. Thanks so much for taking time to join us on Rock Conversations.
Thank you very much.